We are in Revelation chapter 17, and we're going to go ahead and read verses 3 through 6, which is really rereading what we were looking at last week, and we'll review that for a few minutes, Lord willing, and then move on from there down into verse 7 and beyond. But we'll ask Brother Glenn to go ahead and read verses 3 through 6 of Revelation 17 as we begin.
So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting upon a scarlet covered beast, full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and 10 horns. And the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet color, and decked with gold, precious stones and pearls, having a golden cup in her hand full of abomination and filthiness or fornication. On her forehead was a name written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. And I saw the woman drunken with the blood of the saints, and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I wondered with great admiration.
Okay, so the Apostle John is carried in the Spirit into the wilderness, and we spent quite a bit of time last week looking at how God worked with his prophets, the pattern that he worked by to speak to them in visions and dreams. He would speak his words to them, and many times in those visions and dreams that he gave in which he revealed his word and spoke his word to them, he would have those prophets engage in activities that were very real experiences. Those visions and dreams to the prophets that received them. And so there's another example right there with John being carried away in the spirit into the wilderness. So in the spirit, he's there in the wilderness. Of course, his body is on the Isle of Patmos. He is not physically moved, but is, as it puts it, in the spirit. Now, in the wilderness, is there any significance to that? Well, perhaps, I mean, because this context that we're still in chapter 17 actually has its beginnings where? I know we've had some shifts or some twists and turns, but there's been an overall context that's been flowing right down to where we are now. From which point in Revelation? Chapter 12. That's where we shifted gears from everything, the first 11 chapters. Well, you had the letters to the seven churches in Asia and those things from the introduction to that point in the first three chapters. But then chapters 4 through 11 had to do with the Father on his throne, and then the Son, the Lamb, who was then given a book sealed with seven seals, and he loosed those seals. And all the events that had to do with that were carried from 4 to 11. And then in chapter 12, we had this change at the midway point of the book to where there was that vision, great wonder given to John in heaven, this woman that appeared there, and then who was with child and delivered her child, and then this great red dragon sought to destroy it and to persecute the woman in her seat. And that great red dragon was Satan, identified as Satan there. And since then, everything has just kept moving along or going from that point. But the context of this part of the book of Revelation has still remained intact. As far as the wilderness, that could certainly have its roots back in chapter 12, because we see the work of the dragon, the description of the beast this woman's riding on with the with the seven heads and 10 horns. We went back last week and looked at some of that material from chapter 12 onward. I mean, the dragon himself, what did he have in his appearance in verse 3 of chapter 12 when he was introduced? Seven heads and 10 horns. And where did he chase that woman and persecute her? Well, it was again out in the wilderness that he went there in chapter 12. So the woman was given two wings of a great eagle and flew to the wilderness in chapter 12, verse 14. Then the dragon was angry and was making war with the remnant of the seed of that woman at the very end of chapter 12, verse 17. And the seed of that woman are identified as those who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. So here's the devil persecuting God's children, persecuting Christians. Well, that context continued to the next chapter. We had those two beasts, and the first one, which are described or referred to as the beast and the false prophet in chapter 16. But in chapter 13, when those two beasts are introduced, the first one that came from the out of the sea also had seven heads and ten horns, just like the dragon, who it says in chapter 13 and verse 2 was the one who gave that beast his power, seat, and great authority. So the devil was behind that beast and the false prophet that came up from the land later in the chapter. And the beast and false prophet deceived the world, but the ones who weren't deceived, who had the mark of God on their foreheads, did not have the mark of the beast on them, or his the number of his name. They were persecuted by the beast and the false prophet. And so that came down through chapter 13. So we've seen this pattern of the seven heads and ten horns associated with the devil and those he was working through to deceive the world and to then persecute God's people who were not deceived. And so we've seen from that point onward those points come up again. Well, now we're seeing this woman sitting upon a scarlet-covered beast. Where? In the wilderness. That could, of course, have some connection to where all this started in chapter 12, being where the devil was seeking the woman to persecute her. But in any event, whatever significance there might be to the location in the wilderness, here's this woman sitting on a scarlet-covered beast, full of names of blasphemy, which is very much like the beast, that first beast in Revelation 13, and then also has the seven heads and ten horns that we've seen now here for the third time. And this woman sitting on the beast was arrayed in purple and scarlet color, decked with gold and precious stones and pearls, with a golden cup in her hand. And then we spent some time last week looking at the presentation or description of the harlot of Proverbs chapter 7 as being very typical. Here's this woman trying to present herself to be very attractive. Well, for what reason? I mean, she's what's on her head, on her forehead? What's written there? Well, what's in her cup? And that golden cup in her hand, it's full of abomination and filthiness for fornication. And then on her forehead was a name written. It says, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. So really, three different things. There's some mystery to this woman and the beast that she's riding upon. And that's going to come up here in just a moment in the next verses that we're going to be looking at, Lord willing. This mystery of the woman and the beast is going to be revealed there. So there's something, there is some mystery associated with her. And she's also identified as being Babylon the Great, which is that back in chapter 16, just a few verses up, is that great city, it's called, and the great Babylon. It came up in remembrance before God. So here is this Babylon the Great. It's the great city. All right, and then it's also the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. The mother then being referring to what? I mean, if it just had harlot and abomination on her head, I mean, then certainly it would say that she was representing those wicked things. But when it's the mother of that, then what does that tell us? She's not just engaged in it, but what? I mean, she's the mother of that. That's a source, isn't it? I mean, that's the source of the origin of it. So really, this city that is being presented here, symbolized by this woman riding on this beast, is a city that is the source of great wickedness, not just fornication, but the abominations of the earth. So how much sin and wickedness is emanating or proceeding forth from this city that God is now going to judge here? I mean, it's obviously a great deal of wickedness. Her cup is full of it. So how much evil is being done on earth that's being instigated from this great city? And not just that, what's along with the same pattern we've been seeing since chapter 12, what happens to the ones that don't succumb to the temptations, the ones that aren't deceived? Christians. What was the devil doing in chapter 12? What was the beast and false prophet doing in chapter 13? What is this woman drunk upon in verse 6? The blood of the saints. So, is this city a source of wickedness? Yes. Is this city a source of persecution of those who aren't wicked? Yes. Both. And that's the point that's being made here. So she's drunk with the blood of the saints and the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when John the Apostle saw her, it says that he wondered with great admiration. That word admiration, when we use the word admire, that's in a positive sense, like with pleasure or approval. That's not the meaning of the word here. It literally means to wonder or marvel. I mean, it was a sight that to see that would have made anyone that was shown that to wonder at it or marvel over it. But it didn't mean in the sense that that John was pleased with it. Of course not. But it was something certainly that was a wonder. Just like the word there in chapter 12 with that great wonder in heaven that appeared with the woman, and then the other wonder being the red dragon. These things that John is being shown in these visions were wonders, great wonders. And certainly the appearance of this woman on this beast was such. But not something that John likes, or that anyone who is righteous would. I mean, no one that's righteous is going to like seeing someone drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. So the fact that this is Babylon the Great as a source of wickedness, we've noted many times that the literal Babylon of old is long gone at this point. So that's obviously not the city, the literal city being presented here, but clearly that Babylon of old is a fitting symbol of this great city that he is showing here in chapter 17. And we've already seen in several passages in Jeremiah and Isaiah previously in our look at this, going back to chapter 14 when we first started reading about this Babylon, and how that Babylon of old was a source of great wickedness in the earth in her time, as great cities tend to be, or really have always been, from the beginning right down to our present time. I mean, what are the first cities we read about in the Bible? I mean, the first real cities we start to read about, there's a battle right after the flood, and that's when the Lord confused the languages of men because of that. Being the source of much evil when men had no restraint with their language and they put their evil imaginations together and that produced something quite wicked. And so God made all the different languages. Now in our world today, all these different things of different cultures and languages or whatever are the way that would be looked at is something very different than the way it's presented in the scriptures. Going back to the book of Genesis, chapter 11, when those when that happened, I mean, the existence of many different languages on the earth was the purpose of that. Something that was the source of that, was that because of something good or was it because of something bad? I mean, God did that because of something bad. Is it a good thing? Is it a good thing when you have lots of people together of the world with no restraints on their ability to communicate and plan things and do things? That's the point we're making. That's the problem with that's always been there with cities and. They become where people get together and they start doing wicked things and they start planning wicked things. Generally speaking, are you going to find more crime in a city or out of a city? When we say crime, I mean, those are things against the laws of man, but what about against, there's lots of things that aren't crimes, but they certainly are against the laws of God. But how much crime and wickedness are found in cities, and that's the way it's always been. I mean, after Babel, I mean, what cities do we read about next? Sodom and Gomorrah, and I mean, it's just that's the pattern there, and that's continued right on through the rest of the Old Testament. Here in the New Testament, we see that right there. We know the way it is in our world today. Nothing has changed in that. So anyway, the fact that a city, or a really great city, a powerful, a mighty city, populous, with having power, was going to have lots of influence culturally, being a source of wickedness, and also will end up being very often a source of persecution of those that don't go along with all the wickedness, as in what would happen to God's people. That's what's happening here. Was that the case with that Babylon of old? Yes, and we've seen that with its wickedness. But also, as we see right here, the emphasis being on the persecution in verse 6. Let's go back to the book of Jeremiah to chapter 50. And let's see what was going on in Babylon back then. Brother Dave, can you read verses 7 to 18 in Jeremiah chapter 50? I mean, I know we start in verse 7. Verse 1, just to be clear, here's what the Lord spake against Babylon by Jeremiah the prophet. It says it very plainly in verse 1. So when Dave picks up the reading here in verse 7, that's still who he's talking to or about. Okay, Brother Dave?
All that found them have devoured them, and their adversaries said, "We offend not, because they have sinned against the Lord, the habitation of justice, even the Lord, the hope of their fathers. Remove out of the midst of Babylon, and go forth out of the land of the Chaldeans, and be as the he goes before the flocks. For lo, I will raise and cause to come up against Babylon an assembly of great nations from the north country, and they shall set themselves in array against her. From thence she shall be taken, their arrows shall be as of a mighty expert man. None shall return in vain. And Chaldea shall be as spoil. All that spoil her shall be satisfied, saith the Lord. Because you were glad, because you rejoiced, O you destroyers of my inheritance, because you are grown past the fat, as the heifer at grass, and dull as bulls, your mother shall be sore confounded. She that bared you shall be ashamed. Behold, the hindermost of the nations shall be a wilderness, a dry land, and a desert. Because of the wrath of the Lord, it shall not be inhabited, but it shall be wholly desolate. Every one that goeth by Babylon shall be astonished, and kiss at all her plagues. Put yourselves in array against Babylon round about. All ye that bend the bow, shoot at her, spare no arrows, for she hath sinned against the Lord. Shout against her round about. She has given her hand. Her foundations are fallen. Her walls are thrown down. For it is the vengeance of the Lord. Take vengeance upon silver from Babylon and him that handleth the sickle in the time of harvest. For fear of the oppressive sword shall they turn every one to his people, and they shall flee every one to his own land. Israel is a scattered sheep. The lions have driven him away. First the king of Assyria hath devoured him, and last this Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, hath broken his bones. Therefore thus saith the Lord of hosts, the Lord, the God of Israel, behold, I will punish the king of Babylon in his land, as I have punished the king of Assyria.
All right. This is the symbol that God is using here in Revelation. It's one reason we keep going back to various passages in the Old Testament about this Babylon. Because we're not going to understand the points in Revelation, well, what he says in chapters 14 and 16 and 17 and 18. All this material that's in here about this Babylon, this symbolic Babylon, not going to understand it as a symbol if you don't understand what the scriptures spoke about that original one. Because that's the point he's making out of it. Well, God destroyed and judged and destroyed the original Babylon. Why? Well, he gives two main reasons there in those verses that Brother Dave read for us. How many times is it mentioned about how she sinned against the Lord? I mean, she was a source of wickedness, much sin. Then, what do we also see emphasized there, particularly verse 17? Who did she scatter? She was a persecutor of God's people. Now, of course, God used that. That was part of his punishment of the people. But still, does that excuse or justify the one that is doing it? No. So, that Babylon was a source of sin and a source of persecution and destruction upon the people of God. So that was the reasons that God gave for her destruction. Well, what's he pointing out here in chapter 17 about this Babylon, this figurative Babylon, this great city? It's a source of wickedness and sin. It's the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. What else is it? I mean, here the city, as this woman symbolically, is drunk on the blood of the saints and of the martyrs of Jesus. So we're seeing the same things there. This is why God is going to bring his judgment upon this city right here, which has got its echoes from back there, what we were just reading there in Jeremiah chapter 50. If we can see that similarity, that's why he's making it a symbol. Well, back in Revelation 17 now, when John sees this, he wonders with great admiration. Again, that is the word for marveling, not in an approving manner. But the question is going to come in verse 7 about why was he marveling at it. The mystery is going to be revealed then. So let's look at verses 7. Let's look at 7 through... We'll stop at verse 11. Let's break that up. 7 through 11 right now for the time.
And the angel said unto me, wherefore didst thou marvel? I will tell thee the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carrieth her, which hath 7 heads and 10 horns. The beast that thou sawest was and is not, and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit and go into perdition. And they that dwell on the earth shall wonder, whose names were not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they behold the beast that was and is not and yet is. And here is the mind which hath wisdom. The 7 heads are 7 mountains on which the woman sitteth. And there are 7 kings. 5 are fallen, and 1 is, and the other is not yet come. And when he cometh, he must continue a short space. And the beast that was and is not, even he is the 8th, and is of the 7th, and goeth into perdition.
Okay, so quite a lot in there. But here's the angel that's showing, which is one of the 7, going back to verse 1, talk with John here, and and is showing him all of this. So this angel says to, and we're not told which of the seven it is, but it's one of the ones that had those seven last plagues that he first started seeing at the beginning of chapter 15. And then they poured out their plagues in chapter 16. But one of these seven angels is speaking to John here in verse 7 of chapter 17 and says, "Why did you marvel?" And says, "I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries her, which had the seven heads and ten horns." Who has the seven heads and ten horns? Is it the woman or the beast? It's the beast she's riding. That beast she's riding bears very great resemblance to both that beast of that first beast in chapter 13, as well as the dragon from chapter 12, which was Satan, the one that gave the power, seat, and authority to that first beast. So the unmistakable similarities to Satan or associations there. I mean, this is obviously, this is all evil here that he's describing in this way. But the mystery of her and this beast is going to be revealed now, which is part of what the name on her forehead was, mystery. So without this being revealed now, I mean, what would we do with this if we didn't have this, the words from the Apostle John that were revealed to him by the Lord through this angel in this vision, telling us what these things are? You ever thought, what would we do with Daniel chapter 2 with that vision that Nebuchadnezzar was given there with that that great image that had the four parts and then the stone that was cut out without hands that smote the image on the feet, destroyed it, and then became a great mountain and filled the whole earth? If we didn't have the description, the interpretation from God of all the four parts of that image and of that stone, what all that meant, what would we do? Well, we'd read it and say, that's interesting, but that's all we could do with that. I mean, unless we were willing to go off and use our imagination, like so many people do, but that wouldn't be right, would it? We would end up being speaking where the Lord didn't, which is not what we want to do. But we would not understand, we would not know without God telling us. So here is a mystery, but this mystery is being revealed here. So he says, "I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries her, which has the seven heads and ten horns." All right, now he starts speaking about the beast first in verse 8. "The beast that you saw was and is not." All right, that's a couple of things there, important things. Was and is not. Well, the fact that it was, but is not. Now, he used language, this type of approach in describing, and has in Revelation a few times concerning the Lord. In chapter 1 and verse 8, when describing the Lord God Almighty, how is he described in Revelation 1 and verse 8? Well, he's the beginning and the ending. What does that mean? Which, he says, which is, and which was, and which is to come. So we can see what it means, those kind of words mean when it's applied to God. Was, is to come. Beginning and ending. What does that tell us? Eternal. Was, is, will be. Is the beginning, is the ending. I mean, that's it. So this is the eternal one. All right, well, here's this beast that he says was, but is not. See, not that's very different than God, who was, is, and is to come. Well, this beast was and is not and is going where? So this beast has a past. He's done his work. And just based on the description of the association here, what kind of work has he done? What's his past? What's his history? We don't have to be given the details, just knowing what he says right there. I mean, this beast has been involved in evil. I mean, there's no other way around that. But when he says, and is not, Well, is he going to continue, or is he focusing here on something is now going to happen to this beast? Well, it's God's judgment that's coming, and where is this beast going? It says, and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit and go into perdition. Does that sound like a good thing? Not for that beast. not from its perspective. But this is showing, okay, whatever this thing was, whatever it was doing, it's not going to continue, is it? And it's what's carrying this woman, which is the city. So whatever, and the degree of wickedness that has come from all this is vast, obviously. A full cup of all this abomination and fornication, all this evil. But here are Christians reading this, and I mean, they got an example of it in their time, with the persecution and wickedness that was going on in the Roman times that they lived in. But what happens to, whether that was, you know, what, looking at Rome, well, we already saw when he was describing Babylon herself, the symbol of this, and what happened to her. And what did he say in Jeremiah 50 when he was talking about that, those verses that Brother Dave read a while ago? When he pointed out Babylon, he said that what's going to happen to Babylon is like what happened to whom? Assyria. And that wasn't the first example either. What happened to Sodom and Gomorrah? I mean, you can look at the examples over and over again, but what happened, focusing the attention on Babylon, that he's using as a symbol here, well, what happened to that Babylon? How easy would it have been for the Jews in Jeremiah's time when Nebuchadnezzar was the king of Babylon? I mean, Babylon was unrivaled. He was that head of gold in that vision in Daniel chapter 2. I mean, he was unparalleled in power on the earth. I mean, that was in the vision in Daniel chapter 4. You remember that one where Daniel was given that vision of that great tree in whose branches all the fowls of the earth dwelt, and under whose shade all the beasts of the earth dwelt. And when he described what that was, I mean, he was describing, and then it got plucked up by, the tree got plucked up and only the stump was left behind. I was talking about that Nebuchadnezzar and his kingdom, but when he was describing it as a tree under which all living things dwelt or in its branches, I mean, he said that he had a kingdom and dominion and power that was unlike anything on earth. Well, if someone lived in a time of something like that, how easy would it be to, from that perspective, to envision that not being in existence anymore? That really wouldn't be easy. I mean, for us. I mean, how easy is it for us to imagine no United States of America? I mean, it's just not. This is all we've. I mean, we are all from. This is where we're from. This is what we've been in our short lives. All we've known our entire lives is. Our country being the most powerful country on earth. I mean, that's it. That's right. That's all we've known. It's very difficult. At least it's difficult for me to imagine that not being the case, because that's all I've ever known as far as the way this world is concerned. But what do we know about all these nations and kingdoms? I mean, they have their end, and I mean that's the way it's always been. And I mean, you can think of the Jews in Jeremiah's time when Babylon was at its peak. How easy would it have been for them to have heard those words of the prophecy of her destruction, really been able to grasp that or to envision that, the reality of that? That would have been very difficult. And as it would have been for the Christians at the end of the first century when they were being dominated by the Romans, as they were, I mean, how powerful was Rome then? To imagine no Rome, all that gone? I mean, that would be very difficult. So, I mean, anybody in any age with any power like that would be very difficult. But yet, what do we have as far as the patterns? of it. I mean, that's the way it's always been. That's a big point of Daniel 2 about the earthly kingdoms, unlike the kingdom of God. That's what makes the kingdom that we're citizens of, the heavenly one, the eternal one. I mean, it has no end. That's unlike anything of this earth. So the earthly nations and kingdoms, they do have their end. But that's a point he's making here. This beast was, but he says it's not. And it's going to ascend out of the bottomless pit and go into perdition. So he's plainly saying that this beast upon whom this woman is riding, is it going to, all the evil, whatever it's done, is it going to continue to be that way forever? No. And we can be assured of the same thing in whatever way. I mean, we know that God is ultimately going to bring an end to this whole world. And so whatever's happening at any time, we can remind ourselves of passages like this. I mean, God is going to judge wickedness, and he's going to bring to an end all things on this world, on this earth at some point, according to his will. And so it would be of this beast. Now, he does mention ascending out of the bottomless pit. Now, we've read about the bottomless pit few times already in Revelation. When was the first time we were reading about that? The first time was back in chapter 9, when the fifth angel sounded, which was the fifth angel of the seven that were associated with the loosing of the seventh seal. And in Revelation chapter 9 and verse 1, when that fifth angel sounded, the Apostle John saw a star fall from heaven to the earth, and to him was given the key of the bottomless pit. And he opened the bottomless pit, and there arose a smoke out of the pit, as the smoke of a great furnace, and the sun and the air were darkened by reason of the smoke of the pit. And then what happened? I mean, this was a source of the smoke came out with locusts upon the earth. Those locusts had a king over them in verse 11 of chapter 9, which is the angel of the bottomless pit. And so that was one of the woes. That was the first of the three woes that were of those, which were the last three angels of the seven associated with the loosing of the seventh seal. That bottomless pit was the source of something nasty. That's the way it was in chapter 9. It was the source of a great woe that brought affliction on those wicked people there. Well, then we read about it again in chapter 11. In chapter 11, the two witnesses that the Lord had there that were giving the Lord's testimony, preaching his word. But when they finished that, in Revelation 11, verse 7, it says, "The beast that ascends out of the bottomless pit will make war against them and will overcome them and kill them." So was that a source of something good then? No, not at all. And we see this not being anything good at all in the book of Revelation. Well, we're seeing that again. This beast is going to ascend out of that bottomless pit, but then go into perdition. In chapter 20, we're going to read about it again there, Lord willing. When we get there, we can take a preview now. But there was an angel that came down from heaven that had the key of the bottomless pit with a great chain in his hand. And he laid hold on the dragon, that old serpent, which is the devil and Satan, bound him 1,000 years, and cast him into the bottomless pit and shut him up and set a seal upon him so he couldn't deceive the nations anymore until that 1,000 years was finished, when he would be loosed for a season. We'll get into all the details of that later, Lord willing. But anyway, just from chapters 9, 11, 17, 20, those four chapters in Revelation where this bottomless pit comes up, is there anything good in there? Nope. It's consistently being the source of something quite bad. And so this beast says will ascend out of the bottomless pit, but then go into perdition. Well, that's what's going to end up happening to Satan, the beast, the false prophet. These characters from chapters 12 and 13. That's what ends up happening in chapter 20 with them. So there's the ultimate judgment of the very source of all this evil. The devil himself, as well as all that the devil was using in his work. So God was going to bring that judgment on them all. So here, this beast was, but is not, will ascend out of the bottomless pit and go into perdition. And when that happens, what does it say about the people on that dwell on the earth? They're going to wonder when they behold the beast that was and is not and yet is. Well, is not but yet is. He says he's going to go into perdition, but it hasn't happened yet. So is there still something left in him? Yeah, but it's obvious from the way he's describing that that's soon going to come to an end. But who are the ones that are marveling or wondering at this beast? Well, who were the ones marveling at the one in chapter 13 when he came up out of the sea? I mean, that was an impressive thing. But what does it say in chapter 13 and verse 3? All the world wondered after the beast. Well, this beast, who's wondering after it? Yeah. They that dwell on the earth, whose names were not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world. So in both cases, the ones that are allured by this thing, that follow it, they're not God's people. Again, this is something evil. Now, it is interesting how he describes the Lord's people there. The Lord's people are described in contrast to those who are not. Well, what is the distinguishing characteristic that he uses in Revelation 17, verse 8, between those who are the Lord's people and those who are not? Whether or not our name is written in the book of life. He's going to get into much more detail about that in chapter 20 at the end of it, when the day of judgment comes. Now, the first reference to this book of life was back in chapter 3 in the letter to the church of Sardis. What did he pronounce that would be the blessing for those who overcome? Blessed are those who overcome whose names will not be blotted out of the book of life. So there are a couple of important points about the book of life. And when we get to Revelation chapter 20, what happens if someone's name is not written in the book of life there at that point? Well, that book of life was opened. What does Revelation 20, verse 15 say? Let's see. Where are we here? Is it you, Tom, or Brother Ted? Ted. Okay, can you read Revelation 20, 15? So based upon that statement, where do we want our name to be written for sure? In that book of life. Well, what does he say? That's what will happen to those whose names aren't there. What about those whose names are there? Chapter 21, verse 27. Brother Glenn.
And that shall in no wise enter into anything that defileth, neither whatsoever worketh abomination, or maketh the lie, but they which are written in the Lamb's book of life.
Now that's the chapter about the city foursquare, heaven. No one is going to enter into heaven that defiles or works abomination or makes a lie. But who will enter into that eternal city, the city four square. Those, they which are written in the Lamb's Book of Life. So look at the contrast there. Not in the book, lake of fire. Are in the book, city four square. Is there any other? Lake of fire and cities four square. Well, that's heaven and hell. Or hell and heaven, if we're going to keep it lined up right, respectively. Any other place? You know, there's some people that believe in like a limbo or purgatory, something in between. Is there any in-between place? Is there any third place or fourth place or fifth place or no place? I mean, is there any other option for what comes ultimately for us in eternity other than either or of those two places? That's it. I mean, it's appointed unto man once to die, and after this the judgment, Hebrews 9:27, and after that judgment day, it's one or the other for eternity. What's going to, the way he's describing it there, what's going to dictate or determine which of those two destinations we end up in for eternity? Whether our name is written in the Lamb's Book of Life. That's an important book, isn't it? Now, of course, the Lord tells us what it takes to have our name written in there to start with and what it takes to keep our name written in there. Because the whole point in that letter to the church at Sardis, they were on the verge of having their name blotted out. Because God's writing instrument is not just with one end. We like having pencils that have erasers on the other end, right? So does God. He writes in, but he takes out. Now, a lot of people like to think that he only writes in, but once you're written in, there's no taking out. That's not the way the Lord describes it. And if we overcome, our name won't be blotted out of the book of life. So there are certain things we have to do to have our name written there. And of course, Hebrews chapter 12, 22 and 23 tells us that it's that that heavenly Jerusalem, that spiritual Zion, which is the church, whose names are written in heaven, he says there. So what do we have to do in order to have our name written there? Well, we have to be in his church. So whatever it is that we have to do to be in his church is what we have to do to be in it written, have our name written in heaven in that Lamb's Book of Life. Is it, another way of asking that, is it possible to be in Christ without being in his church? No. I mean, how do we put on Christ? Galatians 3:27. How do we enter into the one body? How are we added to that body? 1 Corinthians 12:13. We're all baptized into one body, which is Ephesians 1:22-23 says that's his church. The church is the body of Christ. So we're baptized into that body. When we're baptized into Christ, the Lord adds us to his church, which is what he was doing in Acts 2:47. At the same time that God adds us, that's when he adopts us as his child. That's when we become a child of God. That's when we become a Christian. That's when our sins are washed away. That's when we put on Christ. That's when we're added to his church. And that's when our name is written in heaven. I mean, the scriptures teach all of that comes together at the same time when we've obeyed his gospel. That's how we start. That's how we are born again. That's how we have life spiritually to start with. Our name is written in heaven in that book then. Our task then is to do whatever he teaches us to do, to run that race, to put on that armor of God, to stand against the wiles of the devil and overcome so that our name stays there and we don't have our name removed from it. And in the end, if we have done the Lord's will, when we're judged there by our works, as he describes it at the end of Revelation 20, if our name is there, we're going to be entering that city four square. If our name was never there to start with, where do we end up? I mean, how many people believe you don't really have to be a Christian to go to heaven? Yeah. You don't even have to, just with the things that we've looked at in Revelation, the teachings of the book of Revelation, even just looking at the teachings in that one book, can we rightly conclude that there's hope of eternal life for anyone that's not a Christian? I mean, this book, it greatly emphasizes that point. We have to be in Christ to be victorious and ultimately to be saved. If we're not, we're going to be destroyed. I mean, that is, if we wanted to look at the main point of the book, I mean, that's really what we're seeing over and over again described and shown to us in so many different ways. But it comes down to that. I mean, we see the prevailing of God's people in the end, and we see the ultimate judgment and destruction of those who aren't. But we have no hope of going to heaven and having eternal life outside of Christ. None. We do have great hope and the promise of God if we do what He says to do, that we will have that for our eternal destination for in Him. But the things that He says we have to do to have our name written in the book of life, when we tie that in with other scriptures, it all goes with everything else He says about becoming a child of God. We can't be saved outside of His family. We can't be saved outside of His kingdom, outside of Him. And all that goes together with our name being written there. So when He's describing here in Revelation 17 and verse 8, the ones who are of the world, they're the ones whose names are not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world. These are people that, I mean, they... This will include all those who never were a Christian. Who else is it going to include, according to what we saw in Revelation chapter 3 with the church at Sardis? It's also going to include Christians who didn't run the race and didn't overcome. Those who quit. And for whatever the reasons are, for the love of this world, for because of not would be willing to endure persecution anymore, for whatever the reasons are, if we decide to go following after that dragon and whatever he's using to deceive, and we fall for it, just like what happened with those people here in Revelation, then that our name will go out. I was going to ask the question, if our name was in but then is out, I mean, are we any better off than if our name was never there to start with? Well, no, in fact, we're worse off then than if our name had never been written there. I mean, it's going to be a much worse perdition for those who had their name there and then got it blotted out than those who never had their name written in there in the first place. But we shouldn't be trying to say, well, now which kind of perdition do I want, the lesser or the greater? How about we vote for no perdition at all? Salvation, that's what we all need. And that's what's available. But He's showing us right here, we've got to do what He says we have to do. And how much of that's going to be involved in, with enduring persecution? I mean, that's a big thing. It's a big point here. That was a big deal. I mean, that what was going on with the Christians at the time of this book was written. That was a major situation at that time. That's one of the reasons why this book is so heavy on that subject. But we're all going to suffer persecution. It's relevant to us all at any time in which we live. But it's interesting to see that as he's going back to this, making reference again to this book of life, and the ones that are of the world don't have their names written there. And they're the ones that behold the beast that was and is not and yet is. So he's got a bit more to say about that and about the seven heads and ten horns and then what's going to come from all of that down to the end of the chapter. So sadly, we're out of time tonight. But keep looking at Revelation 17 between now and our next time, and Lord willing, actually it won't be next Wednesday night, will it? Next Wednesday night, Lord willing, will be in our gospel meeting. So Brother Paul Powers will be using this time to preach the gospel of Christ. So we'll have to set aside this study of Revelation 17 for 2 weeks, Lord willing. So we'll try to get back to it then. We'll go ahead and stop tonight and wait for everybody to get in here so we can make our announcements and so forth.